Please be seated. The clerk will call the first case.
122-1039,
In re Marriage of Andrew. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Illinois Appellate Court, 1st District, 5th Division. We have one case on the agenda for today. We're going to ask first that the lawyers who are going to argue please step up and introduce yourselves.
Good afternoon. My name is Alan Gabe. I'm the attorney for appellant petitioner underlying case Benjamin Andrew.
Good afternoon. My name is Joel Ostrow. I'm here on behalf of the respondent appellee Jacqueline Andrew.
Thank you, counsel. We'll allow 20 minutes for each side for argument. The appellant will have an additional 5 minutes in reply. We will let you know that we have read the briefs. We understand what the facts are. We tend to have lots of questions, so be prepared for that. And with that, we will excuse Mr. Ostrow to the council table, and Mr. Gabe may proceed when he is ready.
Thank you, Joe. We're before the court today, because we believe that the trial judge made reversible error in four areas. Where he granted the respondent's 2619 motion, where he ruled that res judicata barred us from proceeding with our amended petition for invalidity of marriage, where he ruled that he could not invalidate a marriage that already doesn't exist, and that maintenance cannot be terminated. As we all know, a 2619 motion admits the legal sufficiency of the complaint. And we believe that our complaint, our amended petition, did such as that. Here are the facts of the case, and I know that you read it, but I just want to repeat them for the record. Section 11-1.20 of the Illinois Criminal Code states in pertinent part, and I will quote, a person commits criminal sexual assault, if that person commits an act of sexual penetration and is 17 years of age or over and holds a position of trust, authority, or supervision in relation to the victim, and the victim is at least 13 years of age and under 18 years of age. These are the facts that we allege. Fact, my client was 16 years of age when the respondent started grooming him. Fact, my client was sexually assaulted repeatedly and frequently by the respondent from the time he was 16 to 18, which is something the respondent never denied. Fact, respondent used her position of trust, authority, and supervision as his teacher, as a coach, and a counselor in his high school to take advantage of my client. Fact, after years of therapy and years of depression, my client finally had a breakthrough on September 28, 2020, where he realized what had happened to him when he was a minor.
Mr. Gabe, I'm having a little bit of a difficulty with the case. We frequently deal with cases where there's an allegation that a person's free will was overborne. The classic case, the most common case that we deal with, would be a coerced confession in a criminal case. In this particular case, so we're not talking about a period of time where a person was a minor, lacked capacity. We're not talking about like a McDonald case where someone was adjudicated and had a guardian and couldn't consent. We're talking about a period of 20 plus years where you maintain your client's will was overborne, not on all topics, no, quite specifically, only with respect to matters dealing with his now ex-wife. That's pretty remarkable.
Well, there's the problem I have. These are questions of fact. Did indeed my client have that problem? Because when he was 16, he was repeatedly sexually assaulted. That's a question of fact. And that question of fact should not be determined on a motion practice. That should be determined by a trial, where we can bring in testimony of not only my client, but his therapists and the counselors who have helped him through his depression all these years, when he finally got over the emotional distress that he incurred.
But doesn't the law promote the doctrine of finality?
in the doctrine of what I'll call fairness, all right, because your client himself filed a petition for dissolution of marriage, right?
That's correct.
And then he entered into a marital settlement agreement, which is under the auspices of the court, and then years later comes now with the petition for dissolution. And, you know, res judicata is one of the issues floating out here. But why isn't this barred by res judicata or latches or, hey, it was a binding contract? And by that point, he's an adult, he's very successful, and all of that is, when you talk about, you know, the facts, they're all in the pleading. All these facts are recited. We know how old he was. We know how many years went by. We know the history. So, all that being said, how do you still state a cause of action to invalidate the marriage?
Because, as the court knows, there are many cases where people have been sexually abused. I look at this case, had the positions been reversed, if my client was a woman and the teacher was a man, there are a plethora of cases out there that show where women were traumatized when they were early in their youth, and then they finally came to the realization how they were sexually assaulted and raped. And then they were able to go back. And the statutes have changed over the years, where now a person who was raped years ago can go back because they finally realize what happened to them. And that's what is happening to my client in this case. And that's why we're asking that we go back and let a trial judge determine the facts. Are the facts sufficient that we can prove it? That's a burden on me, to prove it at trial level, not at a motion call. A motion call says that we didn't state a cause of action. Well, we believe we stated a cause of action. Whether it's a cause of action we can prove is something for a trial judge to determine, not for the motion call.
There's a reference in the briefs to a letter that I believe you wrote on behalf of your client in 2017. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. That letter it's referenced in your client's testimony, but I don't believe the record, the letter itself is in the record. But could you just address what the content of that letter, what was said?
Unfortunately, I don't recall. And rather than try to guess, as I tell my clients, never guess. I'm sorry, but I don't recall the letter. I know that he wanted to work something out with her so he wouldn't have to keep making payments, and he was going to set up, I believe, that he was going to set up an annuity so she would be taken care of for life regardless of what happened to him. But don't quote me on that. I'm just presuming that's what the letter was about. I apologize.
The issue of whether or not your client's will had been overcome as a result of the years of grooming, according to the brief and the documents submitted, all were raised after your client had been held in contempt for failing to meet the terms of the maintenance agreement.
No. We filed our petition to invalidate prior to the filing of the petition for rule.
The petition for dissolution of marriage was filed before your client received the breakthrough?
Yes, absolutely. Because he wasn't aware of it. The petition for dissolution of marriage was
2014.
At that point, he no longer was under her control or coercion because she didn't want the divorce, and he filed for it nevertheless. So he had some agency of free will by that
point. Well, they weren't getting along, which is different than being under the dominance of control.
I understand. I'm just trying to get the chronology straight.
I understand. But you are correct. He filed a petition for dissolution of marriage. That was because they don't get along under the statute. Irreconcilable differences cause irretrievable breakdown of the marriage. Not because of the control. Had he known when he filed that petition for dissolution of marriage of what had occurred to him and before he had the breakthrough, that would have been alleged in his complaint at that time. He would have filed the petition for invalidity at that time, but he wasn't aware of it. You can't file something that you don't know has happened to you.
And
what wasn't he aware of?
He wasn't aware of how the dominance and control this woman had over him for all these years controlled his wife, controlled his life, and made him depressed and throughout the years, and that had he known this, excuse me, back when, he never would have married her.
He didn't know when he was 16 years old that he was having a relationship with his gym teacher who was 43.
He didn't know that that
he was... He didn't know that. He knew that fact.
He did not know that it was sexual assault.
So he didn't know a legal consequence of the fact, but he knew the fact.
Well, of course he did. He had the sex with her. But that was because of the way she dominated and controlled him. She's the one who instigated the sex. She's the one who took him up to Wisconsin. She's the one who bought him all these presents. She's the one who took a boy whose mother had been divorced two times, who had no parental guidance, who was alone and unsure of himself, and she took him under her wing, and she bought him expensive gifts, and she controlled him. And he didn't realize that that control is why he ended up marrying her.
And then in the course of the marriage, which lasted 20 years, he's a successful professional. He's the principal at William Blair. He earns in excess of $1 million a year.
But that's not right.
But yet in this one area of his life, his will is so overcome that he...
Yes, because you can make money doing one thing, but you can still be depressed. Look at all the people who make millions of dollars from suicide. Here's a man who, he was good at what he did at his job, but that didn't mean he was emotionally stable. That didn't mean he wasn't depressed. Why would he go through years and years?
Is very different from lacking the sort of free will to enter into a contract.
Well, if that's the case, that's something to be determined at a trial. Is that, in fact, an issue to be decided at trial, not on a motion? Did he have the free will? That's for a trial judge to determine. Was he able to overcome all of these other obstacles, this obstacle to make money? That's to be determined at a trial, not by motion. A motion call should determine whether or not we stated a cause of action. And our cause of action, though you may not agree with that we can prove it, but it's still a question of fact. A 2619 motion, in all the years I've been practicing, people make it very similar to a motion for summary judgment. You don't get it granted unless there's no question of fact. Well, I believe there's question of fact. In fact, I think you raised some of them. How can he be successful financially, but yet not have the will to overcome the aggression of this woman did to him when he was a child? So that's not to be determined by a motion. That's to be determined by a judge who hears testimony of my client, hears testimony of his therapist, hears testimony of the respondent to know what she did through all those years.
Counsel, it's your position that the point that he had the breakthrough was a change in circumstances according to the statute that would allow him to modify the maintenance at the very least, except that the maintenance has the provision saying it's not modified.
No. What happened was he was going through therapy. And as I said in the brief, and I'm sorry I don't have it, there was an incident that occurred where there was a highly publicized action.
The Jeffrey Epstein matter. He watched it and had a breakthrough.
Right. And that's when he was with his therapist. They talked about it. And then that's when he realized that he had been assaulted like all these women had been during the Epstein matter. So that's when the breakthrough occurred regarding his break from the dominance and control of this woman.
And you are alleging that is a change in circumstances that would allow you to have the issue of maintenance opened up.
That's regarding the maintenance issue, that's part of it, yes.
On the maintenance issue.
Okay.
Are you asserting any basis to modify maintenance other than the coercion, the grooming, etc., which would invalidate the original marriage? Alleging like he lost his job or anything?
No. Okay. No, we're saying that the judge ruled that he can only modify or terminate maintenance if it deals with financial issues, and I disagree with that.
This case is based on the statute in the Dissolution of Marriage Act involving invalidation of a marriage. The statute talks about duress as a basis. But we are a court that relies strongly on precedent and interpretation. What's the best case you have for your contention and your argument that we can, you know, the court should have proceeded to invalidate the marriage based on this set of facts.
Well,
as opposed to somebody being mentally disabled.
I understand.
All the things that, you know.
That's a problem we have with this case, and I've mentioned this to many people. This is, I believe, a case of first impression. And I know it's a big burden on all of us. But what I would rely on regarding res judicata is the case of, that I cited in my brief, I hope I pronounced this correctly, IASU versus the Illinois Department of Financial Professional Regulation. And that was an Illinois Supreme Court case, 2014 Illinois 116023, where the court stated, and I quote, "The rule in Illinois is that res judicata extends only to facts and conditions as they were at the time that the judgment was entered. When new facts or conditions intervene before a second action, establishing a new basis for the claims and defenses of the parties respectively, the issues are no longer the same, and the former judgment cannot be pleaded as a bar in a subsequent action."
But one of the elements of res judicata is that it bars claims not only that were made, but claims that could have been made.
That's correct.
And here we have, you know, the first claim was a dissolution claim, and there could have been an invalidation claim piggybacking along with it, couldn't there?
Our position is no, it could not have been claimed, because he wasn't aware of the circumstances, and he only became aware of it on September 28, 2020. So I read that case, and some people I've talked to went to that same thing, but it's not the same. He could not, as I said earlier, had he known this when he filed the petition for dissolution of marriage, he would have filed a petition for invalidity of marriage. So he could not have filed that claim because it was unknown to him.
Counsel, you began by making a statement that that alluded to the recent trend where statutes are being changed and allowing women to come in and file claims based on rapes that occurred 10, 20 years ago. And I just wanted to make sure that we correct the impression that there's a different standard that we would be applying, because your client is alleging that he was the victim of abuse. It doesn't matter. Gender doesn't matter. Grooming of children.
I understand
the contact between the teacher and the child is reprehensible.
Absolutely, and I didn't mean to imply that. That wasn't my point. It's just that most of the publicity deals with women. You know, this isn't my first time I've had cases with sexual abuse on both sides. You know, I do a lot of orders of protection. I'm a big supporter of WINGS, which Children's Advocacy Center, which deals with this type of issue. So, no, I understand that. I represent a number of men who have gone in and gotten orders of protection for this very reason. So if that's what came across, I apologize. That was not my intent.
And we have about 2 minutes left for you, Mr. Gabe.
Well, you know, I had all these nice things to say, but I think basically we've covered most of it. I don't think there's res judicata, because as the court says, you need an identity of causes of action. I believe we have two separate and distinct causes of action. One is to invalidate a marriage, which means that marriage never existed. The other is a dissolution of marriage, means, yeah, there was a marriage, but now it's no longer in effect. And then in McDonald, you know, the case said, yes, you can invalidate a marriage that doesn't exist. And counsel said in their brief that they felt that the McDonald is irrelevant, and I'll quote, "the marriage was never valid." Well, yes, that's true. And we believe that's the case in this circumstances, that because of what we have alleged, my client's marriage was never valid. Thank you.
Are there any other questions from the panel? No, thank you. We'll see you in a few minutes for 5 more minutes of reply.
Thank you.
Mr. Ostro, you may proceed when ready.
May it please the court, I'd like to briefly address the McDonald case, because in McDonald, it wasn't decided under the invalidation of marriage statute. The guardian, who has been given letters of administration, did file a petition to invalidate the marriage when the putative wife came in and tried to get rid of his letters of administration, claiming they had been married. But he withdrew that petition and just defended against her on the basis of the Probate Act, which said that if there's a guardian of an adult incapacitated person, that person cannot get married without the guardian's permission, which he did not have. So, and that's the basis upon which the appellate court ruled. So this situation is far from that. That marriage was never legal. Here, Mr. Andrew is claiming not that it was never legal, but that I had no free will to enter into it, and I did not know that.
Well, it was entered into under duress, and the statute says marriage entered into under duress is void. Isn't that
but he doesn't plead any facts of duress. All he pleads is the conclusory word duress. In fact, in his initial petition to invalidate, he says, we got married at the insistence of Miss Andrew in Las Vegas. What does that mean? That she said I'd break up with you if we don't get married? I mean, you could probably invalidate half the marriages in the country.
The remedy for that, though, would be to remand and give him an opportunity to amend. If it's just merely a question, he didn't allege enough facts.
Except that all of his claims are predicated on having a mental incapacity, which he claims not to have known about until September 28th, 2020. Now, when you make a claim of mental incapacity, you're supposed to have an affidavit from a professional verifying that you have that. And we cited a couple of cases. I could have string cited if that wasn't discouraged by the rules.
Isn't it a probate rule? It's not a rule for... You don't have to have a medical certificate attached to
it. No, the cases that we cited, Mills versus McDuffie and the Callis case, which was a Rule 23, but I attached it to my in my appendix. The Callis case does say you cannot belatedly claim a mental incapacity and then try to vacate a judgment that's several years old. And Mills versus McDuffie and People versus Johnson and In re Bennett, all of which we cited, they're in different areas of the law, but they all say you can't base a claim or defense on a mental incapacity without having attached either a letter or an affidavit.
Isn't that what discoveries are for? You would disclose an expert the expert, and the expert would give an opinion. How are we supposed to know this stuff, right? I mean,
because the person pleading the claim or defense is supposed to have, it doesn't necessarily have to be their expert who they're going to use at trial, but it has to be a professional who verifies that there was a condition which this person was under.
Healing arts medical malpractice, there's a statute requirement that you have such an affidavit. I don't know of any requirement anywhere else.
Well, I mean, I can't recite all the facts in the cases I did have cited in that regard, but I have. But beyond that, as Mr. Gabe said now and has said in his brief, his client was in therapy for many years, and the standard here for filing, because he didn't really talk about the time bars for the pleadings that he filed, is when somebody knew or should have known. Now, that triggers the beginning of the time bar. And somebody who's been in therapy for a long time and that never came to the fore in all of the years that they were married and all the years he was seeing a therapist, that means one of two things. The therapist didn't diagnose that, certainly the therapist knew what had happened in the history of this marriage. Or the therapist told him quite a while ago, but he would not want a court to know that he knew quite a while ago that this was a possibility.
Is there anything in the record that reveals specifically when he started therapy versus when he filed the petition to invalidate the marriage?
No, it just says on and off for years is what it says. It doesn't have a specific date. But the September 28th, 2020 date is significant, too, because In that petition to invalidate, he does not assert that he was under a mental incapacity when he got married. He just says, he recites the facts of the case, of the relationship, and then says he was under her domination and control, and doesn't explain why, when he filed his petition for dissolution of marriage, went through mediation, had the settlement agreement negotiated by an attorney, swore several times that he was acting voluntarily and under his own free will.
It is a fact, counsel, that your client was engaged in a sexual relationship with a student. Is that correct?
Correct.
And there's some dispute, of course, as to when that began. He's alleging it began when he was 16. I think your brief indicates it was before he graduated from high school.
No, I don't think anyone disputes that. Okay. He was a minor and she was not. And, in terms of the, inferences or references to misogyny that have gone through here, it's equally misogynistic to simply assume that no male in his right mind would marry a woman 15 or 18 years older than he is. I don't want to get into a debate over the facts here because I don't think this is really a factual question. There are two bases on which a court can dismiss on a failure to state a cause of action. One is, we say that he needed something in his pleadings more than his opinion, that I realized when I read about Jeffrey Epstein, who you could have read about since 2006, by the way, and he'd been arrested in July of 2019, and the story was never out of the paper. But he it's also negated by the facts. A cause of action can be negated by other known facts, which make the cause of action not cognizable. And, Your Honors went through a lot of them, and one of them was the letter that was written in 2017. He ex parte reduced her payments. He told her he wanted to have a complete break with her. This is in between
the... But that 2017 letter A isn't in the record, correct?
Is not in the record?
I don't think it's in the record.
I don't think it's in the record.
Okay.
I,
and wasn't it brought up in the offer of proof, which ended up not being admitted?
Correct.
Okay.
That is correct.
How can we consider it?
Because it was testified to under oath by his client. And that's another thing about the practicalities involved here. He's been held in contempt. He did have the ability to pay. He wrote her a check for over $460,000, and he hasn't appealed that. So what are we sending this back for? A hearing to have him present an expert, my 80-year-old client to hire an expert, litigate this thing for 2 years, and completely vitiate a marital settlement agreement that he swore many times that he was entering into under his own free will. And when you consider that they mediated it and then they each had attorneys, I don't know how you could give any credence to someone coming in 6 or 7 years later and saying, I didn't know what I was doing. And based on facts that happened at that point, I think 35 years ago or maybe a little less than that. And yet, I remained married for 20 years. I had a very successful career. We negotiated something where we split up roughly $10 million. And now I can file what's really more of a 214-01 petition than a petition to terminate. And under the basis that something I swore to wasn't true, but I didn't realize it wasn't true.
Let's distill this down to what we have in front of us.
Okay? Right.
We have the petition to invalidate the marriage, which was dismissed on a pleading motion, right?
Right.
Okay. And the pleading in question says it was under duress. I was a minor, I had this relationship, I was a minor. And Mr. Gabe is saying, well, that's enough to take it to trial.
I don't see that.
You know.
I don't see that. They got married 9 years later. He had gone away to college. Illinois is a fact-pleading state. Saying I was under duress is not a fact. Saying that facts are I was threatened,
Wouldn't the allegations related to the differing positions, student-teacher, the age differential, those all play into the claim of duress, right?
Not 9 years later. You might have been under duress when you entered into the relationship, but the relationship continued even when, you know, continued through a separation when he was in college. He's saying I was under a mental incapacity. He's not really saying I was under duress, and he's pled no facts that say how does being in a relationship between somebody who is an adult and does have some authority over you and being a minor end up with you being forced 9 years later, being under duress 9 years later when you go to Las Vegas and get married? I don't think there's a nexus between those things.
Well, that really is not something that you are able to determine or we're able to determine. And isn't that counsel's position that this is something that maybe experts would have to come in and testify whether or not there is such a thing?
I don't think anybody would testify to that. I don't think anybody would say, I can tell you what this person...
What authority do you have to make that statement?
Because I don't think that somebody could come in and tell
you... Right, it's what you think.
Right. Well, this case is based on what he thinks.
But we have criminal cases all the time, Mr. Ostro, where an expert opines as to the mental state of the defendant at the time he committed the crime 8 years ago.
Maybe I don't practice criminal law, but 30 years ago I think is a bit of a stretch. And plus, every single act that he engaged in during the course of filing for a divorce and negotiating an agreement and signing an agreement and testifying under oath, that's every single one of those things are going to be negated. When he said, I had no free will, when he testified, I did have free will, I entered into this freely and voluntarily. Well, he only said that because he didn't have free will. I mean, I think that's just a ludicrous concept. And I don't see how you can try to overcome that with expert testimony. And with regard to the maintenance issue in his petition to terminate, the marital settlement agreement does say that here's the only two bases at which he can come in and modify. And those two bases were, I sell out my interest in William Blair and we split up the money, or I take a different job and I make less money. And which, interestingly, in his reply brief, he says, I knew I was leaving William Blair and going to another job when we got the divorce. But in the general provisions of the marital settlement agreement, it says, other than what's stated in the marital settlement agreement itself, we waive 502 of the Illinois Marriage and Dissolution of Marriage Act, which generally allows somebody to plead for a modification or a termination. So he comes in 7 years later without alleging those two things and saying, well, because those two things are in here, I have a right to modify on any basis that I want to, and that's simply not true. That's why I say this is an end run around the fact that his ability to file a 214-01 petition ended after 2 years. I think, you know, as we argued in the brief, what he has here is a self-diagnosis. And even when he made that self-diagnosis, which he claims he did on September 28, 2020, he filed his first petition to invalidate on October 19th. He did not allege that. He did not allege he was under a mental incapacity when he filed it. And in answer to something you said, Justice DeLord, it was filed on the same day that the petition for rule to show cause was filed, which I believe in the record, Mr. Andrew had been notified that they were going to file a petition for rule because he stopped paying her after July 1st. So there's a 90-day time bar for a petition to invalidate. At the very most, that time bar started to run on September 28, 2020. He did not plead it until his amended petition to invalidate, which was on March 18, 2021. So in a best-case scenario, he's time barred out of it. And I also think Judge Kelly was right. You can't, part of the Section 304 of the invalidation statute says if a court finds the marriage to be invalidated, it should be retroactive to just before the marriage. But then it also says that's a judge can not do that if the judge feels it would be inequitable under the circumstances of the case. And it also says, the statute says that all of the components of a divorce judgment won't apply. So if the marriage is invalidated. So clearly the intent of the legislature was if you were have one of the bases for invalidating a marriage, you're going to have to bring it fairly quickly, and then there's not going to be a divorce. Here there is a divorce. Judge Kelly was right. This marriage was over. This marriage was over under an enforceable contract where all the property was distributed and a maintenance was set, which both parties agreed to, which is always a component of when you enter into a marital settlement agreement, you play off the property division with, is the person going to get maintenance for how long and in what amount? And it's too late to vitiate that. And he does not have a cause of action to terminate the maintenance because he waived that. He waived that cause of action when he signed the marital settlement agreement. And I presume he was well informed of what his rights were when he did file that. And yes, you know, certainly somebody can go to court and have a hearing and say the exact same things that Mr. Dave is saying here, but it's too late. It's time barred, and it is raised judicata because it is the same people, it's the same cause of action, and the issues he's raising now, he could have raised then. And to say the only reason I could have raised then, I could not have raised it then, is because I suddenly realized it 7 years later. Nobody told me that. My therapist didn't tell me that. But when I read about Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell, I realized I was in the same position as the women.
Doesn't the invalidation statute specifically contain language that says that invalidation action may be brought within a certain number of days from when you realize that there were grounds for invalidation?
Well, it doesn't exactly say that. It just says that if you're under a mental incapacity, which is the basis he's using here.
Is it your position that mental incapacity in the invalidation statute, that term, okay, refers to adjudicated mental incapacity only?
Well, if you're going to go to a hearing and try to prove it, absolutely. And
by adjudicated, I mean that the person is under a guardianship.
No.
As in McDonald's.
No.
Okay.
I think it's the same as any other claim of a psychological condition. If depending on the cause of action, if a judge believes that that's true, then it's a good claim or defense. But here, that claim is negated by the history of these two people. And you know, I do stand by, you know, part of what I was going to say here, and I guess I still have a couple of minutes.
2 minutes left.
Okay. Courts have assiduously not allowed that Pandora's box to be opened, where people can come in. I think the Callis case is pretty significant in that regard, but there's many cases where you can't come in and say, I shouldn't have done what I did. I shouldn't have entered this agreement. I shouldn't have entered this judgment because I suffered from some sort of incapacity or duress, which I could have mentioned then, but I just realized that. I mean, you open that Pandora's box, and anyone could go to the, I think it's called the Statistics of Psychiatric SDM, and find a condition and say, you know, I just realized I was bipolar when I signed that agreement, and then they get a hearing because they said that, without any verification at the time of the pleading that that occurred. And in the and in this case, in the presence of a 35-year history, where
a history that began when he was 16 years old, 16, 17, 18 years old, having a relationship with an adult, 10, 20 years his elder, who had a position of authority and trust over him as his teacher, which is prohibited in our general society for reasons that go to the fact that the children are not able to exercise the authority to say, no, stop, go away, you can't do this. So all of those things play into the possible disability. And the point is, I can't determine whether that was real. You can't determine that was real. And maybe there is some credence that they should have some testimony to determine.
I think the facts show that it wasn't
and that's
real.
Not misogyny. If there's any misogyny going on here, it's the fact that people want to assume because it's a boy that that didn't happen.
No, that's not true at all. We recognize that it happened, and we recognize that it was illegal, that it probably had an impact on him, but the impact didn't last through his getting married, being in a marriage for 20 years, and getting divorced, and the standard is knew or should have known.
If your complaint is the absence of a verification, again, isn't the remedy for that to remand, to give an opportunity to provide a verification?
He had an opportunity to. He was allowed to amend both his pleadings that got dismissed. And you're supposed to know what the requirements are of a pleading when you file them. And we don't think he met those requirements. And even if he had, all the things that happened in the interim negated his claim that he had that cause of action. And the should have known standard, you know, you're giving, they're claiming he had no, even though he was going to therapy, he had no responsibility for ascertaining the supposed impact on his psyche for 35 years. And I have an 80-year-old client,
we're veering off here. Your time expired.
Okay,
let me make sure we have no other questions. All right. Thank you, Mr. Ostroff.
I will be brief unless you have some questions. I was listening to what Mr. Ostroff was saying, and it seems to me that he was arguing my position, that we have questions of fact. The words he used were credence, facts, 214.01, duress, mental incapacity. These are all questions of fact. And they brought up in their brief, why didn't we file a 214.01 petition? Well, because that means they would have been married at one time. They still would have been married. That was not the purpose. The purpose was to show that they never were legally married under the statute. And to answer the court's question, Section 302 of the Act states an action must be filed, quote, no later than 90 days after the petitioner obtained knowledge of the described condition.
Okay, so let me ask Mr. Gabe a question that came in my mind as the result of the last argument. The marital settlement agreement, all right, which your client signed well into, he was probably in his 40s or something, right? Even older. Somewhere around there.
Yes.
Okay. It says that the maintenance can't be modified unless he, I think it says, sells his interest in William Blair or even takes another job. Okay. Otherwise, it's permanent, right?
That is what it says, correct.
The ultimate goal here is to eliminate the maintenance requirement, is it not?
No.
No?
The ultimate goal here is to prove that he was never married to this woman.
But in his 40s, he signs the marital settlement agreement. All right? At that point, he'd already filed for divorce.
How do I'm we sorry, get around? Last part.
He had already filed for divorce.
Yes.
Okay. How do we get around the res judicata problem that at that point, he signed in open court a pleading that says, I've agreed to all this under the auspices of the court.
Yes, he did that. He also testified in open court that he read the agreement, he understood it. But he didn't understand what the condition, his mental condition was at the time that he signed the agreement. He didn't know the condition when he got married. He didn't know the condition when he got filed for dissolution of marriage. He didn't know when the marital settlement agreement was negotiated or signed or when he testified. None of that was to his knowledge of what occurred. It finally came out in September of 2020. That's when he realized that all of this should never have happened. It all goes back to the same thing. And it's all a question of fact, in my mind. Yes, is there a question, well, did he really think this?
What's your view of counsel's argument that you're required to supply an affidavit or some sort of a verification?
Those cases, that I recall, they were not at the pleading stage, if I recall. They were at trial. There was no testimony that he, you know, that he came in and my client came in and said, oh, I have this problem. And we don't bring a therapist in or professionals, yes, then he should not be successful. But yeah, I don't think it's necessary to do it at the pleading stage because that is, and I keep saying this, a question of fact. And I feel I'm like a broken record. This is all a question of fact. And I don't think, again, that it should be determined on the motion practice. This has to be set to trial. I have nothing further unless justices have any further questions.
Any questions from the panel? If not, we thank you for a very interesting case, which was well briefed on both sides. The court takes the matter under advisement, and you will hear from us in due course.